Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A late and merciful rally today helped Wall Street markets stagger to a lackluster close after a wild day that at one point saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 440 points. Despite a week of market woe, President Bush was upbeat in a speech this morning. He said that America is suffering from what he called a hangover after the economic binge of the 90s, but that overall, the U.S. economy is strong.
Listen to the facts. Inflation is low. An important part of an economic recovery is to make sure that inflation is under control. It is. We got sound monetary policy. Interest rates are reasonable. People want to borrow money, you don't have to pay a lot of interest. Productivity is increasing. We lead the world in productivity gains as a result of the entrepreneurial spirit and the fine workers we have in America. That's an important indication of how sound our economy is.
Still, Bush's confident message did not seem to greatly inspire investors. The Dow took its sixth consecutive day of losses, closing down 45 points. The Nasdaq squeaked out an 8-point gain. Bargain hunters were out, but no one knows yet where the bottom may be. And the consequences of the market's fall are already piling up. Deep federal deficits, personal deficits, retirement plans, and college savings in tatters. Americans are taking a financial blow to their confidence and the bottom line that analysts say will resonate for years. Tonight, we examine the wreckage and ask how much worse it might get, how Americans ought to respond to market mayhem. Personal retirement plans and 401ks have taken a heavy blow with market losses. What about pension funds? I spoke with Bruce Kallos earlier. He's administrator of the Arlington County, Virginia Employees Retirement System. I asked him how the big tumbles in the stock market are affecting big pensions funds like his.
Our fund is a little bit over $1 billion. We've got a fairly comfortable excess margin in the fund still. We tend to invest the fund in with a very carefully risk-managed profile. We've only lost about 1%, I guess, in the year ending the end of June. And then, of course, we've lost a little bit more since then.
Here we are in a world where people are watching their 401ks being something like gutted over the last week and a couple of years. How did you avoid that? You saw this coming? You got out early?
It's not so much a question of saw it coming or got on early. We're broadly diversified. Our process tends to give us an asset allocation that builds a floor under so that we don't lose anywhere near as much as the market. And we do that by participating in things like convertibles and REITs and some other instruments that unfortunately are not available to regular, you know, retail investors.
Step back then for us. What's your sense of what this market swoon is likely to mean for retiring Americans over the next 10, 15 years?
Well, I would suggest that for people who have a defined benefit where the company or the municipality or state that they work for promises them a particular pension when they retire, those folks are going to do okay, I think. The people who rely specifically on 401k-type investments that got caught up in what's commonly called the big bubble have got a lot of making up to do. And our expectation is that the markets over the next 5 years, probably anyway, will not give particularly strong returns.
And, of course, it's been a larger and larger percentage of Americans in recent years who do depend on 401k retirement plans.
Exactly. And, unfortunately, in the last 20 years, the increase across the markets has been dramatically higher than it's been for the history of the markets. If you look at the 60s, roughly 66 to 82 period, the markets are relatively flat. And then from then it kind of took off, and so people have grown to kind of expect that. And that won't happen, I don't think, going forward. I think that the markets are going to be fairly much like they traditionally have been since, you know, the beginning of the 20th century, and you won't get the double-digit return. So the folks who've lost a lot in their 401ks, I think, have got to very carefully plan out, maybe even change their expectations But I think the most important thing to remember is that you've got to be in the market. I mean, historically, the markets have provided better returns than any place else. And now's not a good time to bail out of the market, in my judgment.
So you say, on the other hand, people are talking about the market not recovering for 5, 10, even 20 years, we've read over the weekend, and no one knows how much lower it might go. It takes nerves of steel, and is it really a good idea to stay in at this point?
Well, as an institutional investor, I would have to say yes. Obviously, history doesn't always repeat itself, but I've always been a strong believer in what's commonly referred to as mean reversion, that markets will swing above their median level and they will swing below their median level, but over time, and sometimes that's long periods of time, they will tend to perform as they have historically. The real drivers on the market tend to be unexpected short periods of time and short bursts, which move the market strongly in one direction or another.
You're spending this week in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, with quite a gathering of pension managers. What's the mood there as the market plummets the last few days?
Well, I guess the mood this morning is, oh, Lord, another clobber today. We're all looking, expecting that particularly the U.S. equity market will not provide the returns that it has over the last 12 or 15 years or so. We're all looking for other opportunities. We're doing a lot of talking about hedge funds. We're doing a lot of talking about real estate and other markets, but really just on the margin, you know, maybe with 5 or 10% of our funds. If we haven't been around for 20 years, we've certainly read the history books, and markets have done this before. The investment professionals are pretty much staying the course, making some modest corrections.
When I hear you saying that retirees may have to adjust their expectations, it sounds like less money to retire on and perhaps more years of working.
For people who rely on the defined contribution plans, the 401ks and the 457s, I suspect that may be the case.
Bruce Kallos is administrator for the Arlington County, Virginia Employees Retirement System. Listeners, what do you think? How do you add up the consequences and the meaning of the market slide? Are you watching the downward march of Wall Street in a panic? Or are you confident, as President Bush suggests, that things should turn around? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Washington, D.C. is David Wessel. He's Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and deputy Washington bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, David Wessel.
Thank you.
It's good to have you back. Also with us from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
David Wessel, what on earth did we observe today? Down this 400-plus points, suddenly we closed down just 45 points. We hear that there's a Greenspan factor in here and maybe some bargain hunting. How many times did you have to rewrite your story today?
I'm beginning to think that maybe George Bush should have gone to Jackson Hole. That seems to be where all the sober people are.
Yeah.
It was a fascinating day. It was a little bit like going to the races and not being sure which horse was going to win. And we did rewrite our story several times. It's sort of scary to turn on the TV and watch the President of the United States try and reassure people and see in the bottom of the screen the stock market falling ever lower as he speaks.
Word by word, practically.
Right. I think it must have shaken up the people at the White House a bit, too. Although the fact that the market came back makes them feel a lot better. I think that it's interesting. I think the president and his advisors have made a mistake, one that Bill Clinton didn't make, largely because Bob Rubin, who was then the Treasury Secretary, was very careful about this. Rubin always said that Clinton should never take credit for the market going up because then he'd get blamed for the market going down, and that he ought to focus not on the markets but on the economy. And I think Bush is trying to do that in what he says, but the juxtaposition of his speeches against the market has been unnerving. At some sense, it's a little unfair to the president because, after all, the market is mostly worried about more skeletons coming out of the closet,
right,
things that companies did in the past that they're going to have to confess to in the next month or two. And the president can't do anything about anything that someone did in the past. And so he's trying to look towards the future, but the market is still looking in the mirror.
David, we want to talk tonight about the consequences of the falls that we've seen already and what may be ahead. But before we do that, because today was such a stomach-churning day, especially when people have already lost a lot and many fear losing more, what do you think did go on here? We read that short traders didn't want to bet against Alan Greenspan, who's going to be speaking tomorrow, afraid that he might succeed in pulling the market up.
Well, I don't really know, and I don't really believe anybody else does either. People sort of look at what happened to the market, and then they reach, like picking an apple from a tree, for the handiest explanation. We do know that there must have been a lot of people who were short the market who then bought it because the market rebounded later in the day. So it's hard to come up with some great unified explanation for why would the market go down 400 points and then come back 425 points or whatever. You know, so it's hard to come up with something. The Greenspan factor is very simple. Alan Greenspan testifies tomorrow before the Senate Banking Committee, and the market will hang on every word and every adverb and every frown and every time he raises his eyebrows. And so some people won't want to be exposed to that because they're afraid that he may sense something that upsets the market. It's a pretty hard day for Greenspan because, on one hand, if he's too ebullient, if he says that the economy's coming back and everything's going to be great, people will begin to expect an interest rate increase, and that'll depress the markets. On the other hand, if he says, oh, things are awful and the market fall is making things worse, that'll depress the market. So it's going to be one of those Greenspan testimonies where he tries to say as little as possible.
Tough to raise it. On the other line put out today was bargain hunting, which, of course, sounds like a life preserver if it means that that some people think we've touched a bottom. Do you hear much of that kind of talk?
Well, you don't hear much of it, but you see a couple things. I mean, there was been a story a few days ago in the papers about Warren Buffett, the famous investor, buying shares in a telecom company. Mm-hmm. If there's ever a sector that's been beaten to death lately, it's telecom. So that's one indication. It will be a bottom when people who have a lot of money and can take a lot of risk and have nerves of steel start buying. When I don't know if that's happening yet. There certainly isn't much evidence of it. Warren Buffett may be a leading indicator.
David, when your, cousin calls and says, you're the smart guy who works for the Wall Street Journal, what the heck should I do? What are you saying these days?
I'm being really careful not to give any advice. Here's the heck out of me. I think that we all have, it is true that those of us who, like you and I, Tom, who've been saving for our kids' college are just going to have to save a little more because we're not going to be able to rely on the market quite as much. And surely some people who are near retirement are going to have to work longer. I think your previous the fellow you interviewed from the Arlington Pension Fund is right. It does seem dumb to, when the market's down, pull everything out. But it is a good reminder that some of the old cliches are the right ones, which including don't put all your eggs in one basket and don't put money in the market that you're going to need in a couple of years because it might not be worth what you put in.
And what about the national consequences at this point, David? We heard that GM is fearing it may have trouble funding its own pension obligations. Are we getting into the point where we're eating our own tail here as the market goes down?
Well, I think there's a risk of that. The economy is much more sensitive to the ups and downs of the stock market than ever before because so many Americans are exposed to it. So when the market goes down, we know that will tend to depress consumer spending, whether because people have less money or because they feel they need to save more for retirement and college accounts. Secondly, it puts a damper on all the moods in the economy, and the economy depends right now more than ever on businessmen feeling sort of optimistic about the future. So they will make the investments that we need for the economy to resume growing at a healthy pace. Maybe they won't invest as much as they did in the late 90s, but we need for them to invest more than they are. And the stock market will hurt on that too. And so there is a risk that we could talk the economy down. The economy, the real economy, the stuff that Bush was talking about today, has actually been okay. But what the fear is that the market downturn, both in terms of psychology and in terms of less wealth, will pull the economy down before the economy can recover enough to pull the market up.
Jack Beatty, these are pretty stiff winds blowing in the last week.
Yeah, they sure are. And I've been out here at this pension forum in Jackson Hole, and people are saying that there's a cascade, one woman said, a fund manager, a cascade of bad news to come, that the Arthur Andersen clients that were picked up by the other accountants, we're going to hear probably from them, and it's going to be one after the other, and these accountants are going to have every reason to make sure that everything gets exposed. And secondly, she says it's just starting to dawn on Wall Street that we've got a budget deficit again, and that the tax cut and the recession have really kind of put us in the hole, and that eventually foreign capital isn't coming here quite as much as it did. And so they're thinking eventually we're going to have to raise interest rates, and that's just the thing they're most afraid of.
Nobody wants to hear. Jack Beatty, we'll be right back. David Wessel, we're talking about the market crumble and its consequences. What have you lost in the stock market swoon? Have you bailed out or sat tight? Do you still believe in stocks for the long term? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the stock market crumble and its consequences. Have your retirement plans been changed in the last year, in the last week? What does the Wall Street crumble mean for you, for the country? And how are you riding out the storm? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking tonight with David Wessel. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief and Economics Columnist for the Wall Street Journal, with our own news analyst Jack Beatty. And we're joined now by Michael Goldstein. He's Professor of Finance at Babson College in Babson Park, Massachusetts. Welcome and good evening, Michael Goldstein.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you. Michael Goldstein, we're still trying to get a handle on this. We're reading people are saying it might take 5-10 years or more for the market to recoup its losses, that we still can't be absolutely sure that we've hit a bottom. There could even be a substantial bit further to go. Why doesn't that add up for the normal small potatoes investor to get the heck out of there?
You know, there's this economic concept that an optimal path once embarked upon remains optimal, which in plain terms means, you know, if you're doing the right thing, you don't need to change what you're doing. So if you're a small person who's about 40 years old, and you're going to retire probably at 70 because we're all going to live a really long time and you're going to live to be 100, then, you know, what happens in the year 2002 to 2004 isn't that much of a big deal. And the danger is you could miss it. Supposing today you decided to sell at, say, 2:30 or 3 o'clock, you would have been down 440 down points. It all recovered right at the end. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be a little bit careful about timing the market. The truth is people have been saying for quite a while now what you should do. Be diversified. Put some in stocks, some in bonds. Don't put so much in stocks that you can't sleep at night if it goes down. And I'd actually say to a lot of small people, look, you know, at one point in time today, your whole value was 5% less than it is right now. If that makes you feel uncomfortable, you still have too much in stocks.
But is that really what the big investors are doing, or are they massively on the sidelines waiting for this thing to bottom out?
Well, a lot of big investors are invested because they need to be. Now, there's a difference between being invested in stocks and being invested in bonds. And so some big investors have pulled their money out and are invested in bonds. But, you know, it's a lot cheaper now than it was a couple of years ago.
And what about the comparable periods of market swoon? I mean, take us back to the big one of the last century, 1929 to 1933. Have we seen losses that are anywhere near what the stock market saw at that time?
Oh, no. That was an economic devastation that's completely unparalleled by this. I mean, we've lost some money. You know, I guess if you bought – I'll put all your money in the market at the NASDAQ high, you might be feeling like it's the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. But in reality, it's not nearly as bad. And it even turns out, again, to remind people, if you had bought stocks at the top in 1929 and held it for 30 years, you would have done better than your neighbor who bought bonds at the same time and kept it in bonds for the 30 years. In the long run, stocks do better. It's just the long run. It's not – Americans aren't big on the long run.
Mm-hmm. David Wessel, are you looking to the lessons of history as you watch this market? Do you hear people reaching for historical parallels?
Oh, absolutely. I think we had a story in the Wall Street Journal today reminding people that in the period from about 1966 to about 1982, the market basically was flat. So that's a period of 17 years where you would have been better off in bonds or bank accounts than in the stock market. And there's a risk that we haven't seen the bottom yet, that the market rose very fast. There were a lot of wise people, we didn't listen to them, but there were a lot of wise people, or few anyways, who warned us that we had a stock market bubble. And it's very hard to say right now, have we seen the worst of it? Is this the bottom? You should get in. Is it still going down? You should get out. I think anybody who says for sure that they know is lying. That's why the idea that you should have a diversified portfolio and not have so much in stocks that you can be devastated if the market does go down another 10 or 20%.
And yet you sense a kind of skepticism out there in that some of the same financial bigwigs who are giving out the same message, stocks for the long term, are now associated with a lot of lying, maybe cheating, maybe fraud in the last 10 years. And maybe potential civilian stock buyers are saying, why should we believe these people when they say stay in the market? Are we being played for suckers again?
I think there are definitely people who are saying that. I think we had a euphoria in the late 90s, and now we have a sort of manic depression among some people that offsets it, and maybe it'll even out. I think the other thing that's going on that's interesting is the reaction of government is like what we have seen in some periods in the past. We have to do something, and this urge in Congress to pass legislation or the SEC to put people in jail, that's a kind of reaction that in the long run may be good for the system because it may fix some of the underlying problems, but in the short run rattles confidence even more.
Could be a tough time. We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Richard's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome, Richard. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. My question relates to what you just said. Where is the historical parallel in corporate lying and falsifying accounting that we all face now? How am I to know that the next financial statement I get from a stock, from a company, is legitimate and real? How do I know? How will I know that there'll be another WorldCom or another Enron 6 months from now in a company that I invested in? I have no way of knowing.
That's the question that eats at people, Jack Beattie. And you know that historically we went through periods where ordinary Americans stayed clear of the stock market in large numbers.
Yes. I mean, we're in a very new world here where suddenly, I don't know, upwards of 50% of the people have some stake in the stock market. Of course, that's not much given rich people and institutions still held the bulk of it, but that makes it a more democratic institution, but at the same time one that exposes more of us to its kind of risk. And, these things have happened in the past. There have been, in the 20s, there were massive schemes built around Samuel Insel, who put together a sort of conglomerate of companies that was a kind of a Ponzi scheme of companies, and that took down millions. There was a Florida land investment swindle and took down hundreds of millions. So there's never been a want of this kind of chicanery in the markets and in the books. I guess the truth, I mean, John Kenneth Galbraith, someone told me when he was teaching in the 60s, he said to his class in the 1960s, he said, "I'm afraid what's going to happen when people forget the lessons of the 1920s and 30s. And in a way, we kind of outlived them. You know what I mean? We forgot about them. We forgot that you got to have a cop on the beat. And you can't, you can only go so far with deregulation. And I think Galbraith was right. That sort of historical memory faded.
Michael Goldstein, how about the level of duplicity that now appears to have been part of the 90s boom, at least in a significant number of corporations? Historically, is this more chicanery, to use Jack Beattie's word, than we've seen in other bubbles and other stock run-ups? Or is this par for the course?
Well, I hesitate to say. Thus far, it doesn't seem like it's more. It actually seems like it's less. There really were some bad things in the 20s. That's why they put, the fox in charge of the chicken coop when Joe Kennedy became the first SEC chairman. Mm-hmm. In the 60s, there were quite a lot of funny things going on as well. So even in the lifetimes of current investors, there's been kind of funny stuff going on. But I'm only hesitant because we don't know where all this is going to stop yet. We're still in the middle of finding out what went wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's partly a function of if you make somebody's compensation a function of accounting numbers and then you put them in charge of the accounting numbers, it should not come as a great surprise that not all the time they're going to not be telling you the truth. Mm. And some of those things need to be fixed. Some strong solutions, some weak solutions. I hope the government will go with more strong ones.
David Wessel, at a time when so many people do not have defined benefit pension plans, they depend on their own savings and their own investing, can Americans afford not to be looking for the highest return on their savings? Or is it just baked in the cake that they have to pursue them wherever they may be, or else they never get to retire?
I think they do have to look for the highest returns, and I think it's foolish for some young worker not to have some money in the stock market. And people who put all their 401ks into these very low-yield, liquid government, short-term government funds are making a mistake, but they're taking a risk, and they have to be aware of that risk. One thing for sure we know is that it's going to be a lot harder for advocates of privatizing Social Security, of turning Social Security into a network of national 401k plans. That argument is not going to sell with people, and it'll force the government to find some other way, I think, to fix Social Security, because I doubt Americans are going to say, oh, that worked out well for my 401k. Let's do the same for Social Security.
We now hear Bush administration officials saying, did we say that? We didn't say that. We were saying something else. Jack is calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Jack. You're on the air.
Yes. What I'd like to make a point on is that we're told, many people are saying we should stay in the market. But if you say you have $100,000 in the market and it goes down 50%, you got $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the market isn't going to be exuberant as it was, you have now this $50,000 has to go up 100% to get to where we were. And what's your thoughts on that?
That is exactly the kind of fear, Michael Goldstein, that's keeping people up at night these days. What do you say to Jack?
Well, Jack, I'll say a few things. First, if you had invested your money 10 years ago today, say in the Dow stocks, and you just got the return on the Dow, you'd still have had a healthy 10% return just doing that calculation. But you're right.
Annual return over that time.
Yeah. But, you know, you're right. Well, first off, it's just a matter of mathematics and statistics. It's always true that if something drops by 50%, it takes 100% to go up. And so when we say the market goes up on average about 13% a year historically, well, you know, that has to make up for some of those downturns when it's lost 25%. But, you know, the other thing is it depends on your age. If you have $50,000 and you're 20 years old or you're 30 years old, leaving it in stocks is not a bad plan provided it's diversified. If you are 75 years old and you have $50,000, you know, boy, you had too much money in the stock market to begin with, and now you really got to do something to move it out.
But what if you're 50, 55, the age where you see retirement coming, you know you've got to be doing the right thing? What the heck is the right thing in that bracket?
The right thing, people say, the right thing this year was the same thing as the right thing 5 years ago, which is as a percentage of about 60-40 stocks and bonds that you probably should be in at that age.
Winston's calling, and Jack, thank you for your call. Winston's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Winston, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Short points. I think there's a perception that Bush is fiddling around while Rome is burning. A similar situation occurred when Clinton was there, and we had the Asian crisis. And bless his heart, he assuaged the American people, and you knew that Robert Rubin was working feverishly behind the scenes, keeping channels open and working out things. I think the first time I heard George Bush say anything on this matter was when he went to Wall Street and he was roundly rebuffed. Perhaps he has not learned the lesson of his father's defeat. The second thing is, I earnestly hope that Bush pushes full force ahead with the legislative things that have to be done with the criminal aspect of false reporting, etc., so that we can make sure that when people read these financial statements, there is a certain air of confidence in them.
Mm-hmm. There's the let's fix it impulse. And Winston, thank you for your call. But David Wessel, how about this Bush front? And I'm particularly interested on the Bush-Clinton comparison because today President Bush seemed to lay this blame for this on Clinton. He said this is a hangover from the 90s. You talked about Clinton and Bob Rubin earlier. Winston says Clinton would have handled it better. Could anyone be handling it better at this point? And I guess more than that, can Bush and Cheney be seen to be handling it sufficiently, given what the history hanging over them?
The president always gets the credit or blame when the market goes up and the economy does well, and the president always gets the credit or blame when it goes the other way. A lot of this has nothing to do with the policies or skills of the two men. There's a certain amount of circumstance here, and I'm not sure that Clinton could have talked the market up any more successfully than Bush did. We do know that the Clinton economic team had evolved a kind of, not initially, they made a lot of mistakes in the beginning, but a kind of gravitas, kind of ability to convince people that you're in good hands here. Rubin was the master of that. And Bush somehow hasn't managed to assemble a team that is quite so reassuring, and that happens to be a real liability at a time like this. That's why Greenspan is so important, because Greenspan seems to exude, I know what I'm doing, even if he doesn't, and people look to him for guidance.
But maybe in retrospect, David Wessel, it was some kind of strange backward handicap to have Clinton and Rubin able to talk us up so confidently. I mean, we got way out over a cliff here.
Perhaps, but what would we have had Clinton and Rubin do? Be less agile, or to say that the market is too high? I did an interview once with Rubin where he very carefully warned that people who are in the market should be thoughtful and take care of the risks. And you could tell if you were sitting in the room that he was trying to say, I think some people are getting carried away with the market. But he never really gave a public statement that said, I think the people who are in the market are fools. Greenspan came close a couple of times. He gave that famous irrational exuberance speech. I think the Dow was about 4,000 then, and it kept going up. I'm not sure we have much experience in presidents or Federal Reserve chairman or Treasury secretaries telling Americans, don't put your money in the market because we're getting carried away. If it happened again, we might do it differently. But given what they knew at the time, given that there was a lot of good stuff going on at the in the economy, it wasn't so obvious then as it is now that it was a bubble.
Listeners, are we getting the leadership we need now to stop the bleeding? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, David Wessel says no president can take full credit or full blame. But this pair surely have some special burdens in talking their way through this.
Yeah, they sure do. And I've been hearing that from these fund managers here, that there's just a lack of credibility for Bush and for Cheney. Cheney because of the Halliburton creative accounting, and Bush because of the loan as a director, and also his own the whole course of things there with him. And you know, someone said to me today, Bush was a director of that company. He got money from it. He was on the audit committee. The company was then doing creative accounting. Were they in effect bribing him not to notice that? You know, that's the kind of thing people are saying. And what I've heard again and again is that Harvey Pitt has no credibility. He might be the most talented man in the world, and apparently he is, but he came in on the opposite presumption. He said, I want to be more permissive on these accounting matters. And they said he just doesn't have the intuitively, you just can't believe that this man can do the job that's necessary.
Michael Goldstein, what's the word in the business school world? Are people saying we've got to have some different figures or a radically different line from these politicians and officials to fix this?
Well, yes, I think a lot of people are wishing that we had stronger legislation for it. People have to base their decisions on numbers. If you can't believe the numbers, it's really hard to make a decision. But at the same time, when the business schools were saying, it's kind of like in Casablanca when they said, we're shocked that gambling's going on. You know, we were the shareholders of these companies, and we kind of asked them to make everything look better, and we loved the ride up. And now we're saying, oh, my goodness, we can't believe that all these numbers weren't true. Well, you know, David Wessel at the Wall Street Journal, man, the Wall Street Journal did a great job of telling us all the way up on that bubble, we really got to be looking at this. You're not looking at it carefully enough. Be careful. Jonathan Clemens said, you know, be careful where you're putting your money. Mm-hmm. And it's not completely everybody else's fault.
Then you had Alan Greenspan reversing course and saying, well, we have a new economy. The old ideas don't apply anymore, forgetting his own warning.
It's a painful day, perhaps a painful week, to be remembering that and everything that's been lost since. And we're talking tonight about the market crumble and its consequences. Are we all in this together, or have some of us been left holding the bag? Do you think we're near the end of this Wall Street toboggan ride? And what would it take to make you a Wall Street buyer again? We're talking tonight with David Wessel, The Wall Street Journal, Michael Goldstein at Babson College. And you are welcome as well at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the big Wall Street market crumble and its consequences nationally, personally, for you perhaps. What have you lost in the stock market swoon? Are we all in this together, or have some been left holding the bag? Do you think we're near the end of this Wall Street toboggan ride? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking tonight with David Wessel. He's economics columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Michael Goldstein, professor of finance at Babson College in Babson Park, Massachusetts, and our own Jack Beatty. And right now, Nina's on the line. Welcome, Nina. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I'm a senior, and about a week or so ago, I decided that I had all the money I needed, and I didn't have to be greedy and wait for the stock market to go up. I just wanted to hold on to everything I had. So I sold all the index funds and all the stuff that I had and put everything into very low-yield bonds.
And how are you feeling about it today, Nina?
Great, because I have enough money for the rest of my life and no problem.
Good for you.
But here's another thing. I have a friend who's somewhat younger than I, and he has money, and he's retired, and he decided to hold on to absolutely everything. He has a great many stocks. And so today he's perfectly happy, too. He's sure that all this is going to go up in his lifetime.
How old is that friend, if I may ask?
Well, he's just under 55, I guess. He's around 55, 54, 55. Mm-hmm. And even if it takes a while, he's got, you know, not just stocks. He's got other things, too. But he's very happy with not doing anything, not selling anything off.
So there's no one-size-fits-all. You're pointing to a real generational issue here, Nina.
Well, kind of, yeah. I think that people who have enough money, it would behoove them to, you know, like, pull in their horns and not expect to get richer if they don't need to be.
Nina, thanks so much for your call. David Wessel, can we tell anything about the market, about who's doing what in this market beyond anecdotal evidence like Nina's? Who's buying, who's selling?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of, it takes a while to figure out what's really going on with the data. And until we get good data, we're stuck with anecdotes. And I think Nina captures something really important, that a lot of people look at the same situation and come up with very different conclusions. And in fact, that's what makes a market work. If everybody thought the same thing, the market would be going through the floor or through the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. But Michael Goldstein, the 55-year-old friend of Nina, who's sitting tight, who's holding on to all of his to his stocks, it feels like an awfully brave move right now. Is he going to end up having to work 5 extra years to get to his retirement if things don't go well?
Well, first off, if you notice he's 55. If he worked 5 extra years, he'd just be approaching the retirement age that most people expect
to
retire.
Well, I don't mean right now, but on the other end, whenever he's expecting
he
to retire.
He may. He's taking a bunch of interesting risks retiring at age 55. But Nina also said a couple things in there, too. He has other investments, so he's not 100% in stocks. And, you know, I'm actually pretty proud of Nina. There's a story from the Bible. You know, the 7 fat years, cows are really great, followed by 7 lean years.
Know when it's enough and be happy.
Just remember that biblical story. You know, you're going to have good years and then you're going to have bad years, and you got to be prepared. You got to save during the good years to get ready for the bad years. Nina sounds like she did it.
When people start quoting the Bible, you know the market's in trouble. Greg is on the line. Welcome, Greg. You're on the air.
Thank you. I actually have a question for David Wessel.
Great.
Who I talked to back in 1987 when the stock market crashed, and all of us thought, you know, this is unparalleled. How do we react to it? And then all of a sudden, it turned itself around. And so what I'm trying to understand is, what is different in 2002 from 1987? Why is everyone so bleak now that we're now talking about 5-10 years before this will correct?
Great question, Greg. Thanks for calling it in. David Wessel.
Tom's the one that's pushing this 5 to 10 to 20 years thing, so I'm going to make him.
Hey, I just read the papers and pass it on.
Look, there's a couple things. One is, we weren't sure what was going to happen after the 87 crash, and you're right, the market came back, and a lot of people then assumed that every time the market goes down, it'll bounce back and it'll come back ever stronger. Maybe that'll happen this time, but we certainly know that doesn't always happen. But the big difference between now and 87 is just how far the market rose in the intervening years. It took any ratio you want, price-earnings ratios, dividend ratios, any ratios you can think of, to heights that are out of whack with historical experience. And that's what makes people think that it's unlikely that we're going to come back from this and have some big post-87 style rebound. I mean, the market is today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average today is about 4 times what it was, despite the recent declines, 4 times what it was in 1987 after the crash.
But I think that's what it has everyone asking here is, who knows how long it will take, but if there is no clear near prospect of much upside, then why hurry back into this?
But how do you know that there's no near prospect? I can tell you a story about we've been through a period of irrational exuberance. A lot of the air has come out of the bubble. Mm-hmm. The U.S. economy is still the envy of the world. Despite our problems, we're still growing. We got whacked by the worst attack on our soil since Pearl Harbor, September 11th, mm-hmm. and yet the economy had a very brief recession. It's now growing again. A lot of the things that Greenspan talked about the new economy, the capacity for information technology to make our lives better mm-hmm. without doing a lot more work, are still with us and are still working their way through the economy. So that if I can give you an optimistic view of the American economy over the next decade, then it's easier to make the case that profits will come back, this period of depression will pass, and you'll be glad to have been in the market 10 years from now.
Well, it all sounds good, but then you're pointing out in comparison to 1987 that we've been at such a high, and it seems too much to imagine we'd have two highs way up in that stratosphere.
It doesn't seem likely to anybody that we'll see the kind of returns on the stock market that we saw in the late 90s. Those were unusually high, and no one that I know of who I trust thinks that we'll see returns like that. But that really isn't the right question. Mm-hmm. The question is, the caller who said, I had $100,000 and now I have $50,000. Well, it doesn't really matter what you had before. The question is, with the $50,000 you have now, what is the best thing you can do with it over the next 10 years? And we know one thing for sure, that you don't know for sure. So the argument is, sure, it would be stupid to put all of it in stocks if that's all your money, because it might be a period where, like the 70s, stocks go nowhere. But it would be stupid to have none of your monies in stocks, because if the market does start going up again, if this is the bottom, then you miss out on those gains. So that's the reason that people, it's not just a middle of the road, six mm-hmm. of one, half a dozen of the argument. It makes sense to have some eggs in the stock market, but not to have all your eggs in the stock market.
That's it. That's the question. Listeners, do you still believe in stocks for the long term? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bruce is on the line. Welcome, Bruce. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm middle-aged, and we've seen our investments drop by half.
Ouch.
But at the same time, we've made sure that we don't have debts. And I'm really amazed the amount of debt out there.
It is enormous.
And if you remember, the Motley Fool used to say mm-hmm. Things like, get rid of all your credit card debt, then invest in the market. You know. So the question I've got is a little odd. What would happen if there was no tax on the interest from insured investments? So if there was an incentive for Americans to have a shock absorber, would banks just lower their interest rate?
In insured investment, you mean of FDIC-insured bank savings accounts?
That's correct. Yeah, and just so you say, if it's in an FDIC account, which you're going to get a lower interest rate on anyway, at least the government won't be pulling money off the interest. In other words, and there's an incentive to put it in there.
So really, you're taking the opportunity to say we've got to save more and be less in debt. Michael Goldstein,
yeah, thank you,
thank you for your call, Bruce. I think part of what we hear may be hear the voice of someone who's lost a lot of money, wants to put it someplace safer and doesn't want to have to pay taxes on it, and now has also a good reason maybe for the government to consider a break to increase savings. Can you imagine that happening?
Can I imagine the government passing that?
Dropping taxes on interest on bank accounts in order to encourage savings among Americans who are fleeing the stock market.
A different way to say it is, Bruce might point out, that the government subsidizes us in taxes when we invest in the stock market, some might argue, by providing a long-term capital gains rate that is mm-hmm. less than what, if you put it in the bank, you might be paying 38%, but the government will subsidize you massively if you you don't have to pay taxes on your long-term capital gains until the end.
You turn it into the fair question that it is. What do you think?
And so, you know, what Bruce may be saying is, hey, that's a little unfair.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we shouldn't penalize people for putting it in safe investments that way. Would more people put it in their investments? Maybe. I mean, look, you're getting only 1 or 2% now if the banks would lower the interest rate a little bit because it would be more attractive. The way to see that is the government does that currently. You can buy municipal bonds and, mm-hmm. You don't have to pay federal taxes on municipal bonds. So
why not here? You can hear the public voice looking for alternatives now that the stock market has given people a big stubbed toe. Jill is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, Jill. You're on the air.
Well, thanks so much. I'm an investment advisor
okay.
here in Providence, Rhode Island. So I have a little bit of a different take on this, which is, I'm getting a little bit annoyed at my industry as a whole by telling everybody just to hold. I think it is the most irresponsible, awful thing to tell people who have lost 50, 60, 70% of their money, and the response is, just hang in there. And I'd love to hear the comments of some of the other folks that are on the line as to...
So what are you telling them to do?
Well, we're boring, so I didn't get to participate on the way up. So I missed the party on the way up, but I'm not suffering as much on the way down. So what we've done is we've scaled back, because the way we manage money is different, we've scaled back the risk along the way.
So are you advising people to get out of the market now, Jill?
We have been advising them. We have not basically – the way we handle money is that we only have a certain percentage allocated to the market.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're saying is, look, it's not smart to hold on to certain assets at some point, so you have to get out of them. And what is very frustrating for me is seeing people whose accounts have been decimated with other advisors, people who they thought were being taking care of these clients, and then they're coming to me and saying, I never want to do this again. And I really can't blame them because they've been raked over the coals.
Mm. Jill, thanks for your call. David Wessel, you can hear every kind of financial advisor has his or her day in the sun. The aggressive advisors looked terrific a couple of years ago. And now Jill is saying the conservative path is the one to trod.
Right. And there are clearly plenty of people who were took too many risks before and now are suffering. There's no doubt about that.
And we had a lecture here today from someone who had a chart showing the performance of value stocks versus growth stocks over time. And you could see that the growth stocks looked good for a while there, but that over time, the value stocks, that is where the price-earnings ratio was sensible, you know, General Motors instead of Amazon,
mm-hmm.
that really is the thing that made sense.
Jack Beatty, did you hear the pension people there sitting tight? I guess you know they're all managing big funds, and this probably isn't pinching them personally that much.
Yeah, I guess that may be true. I mean, what was interesting to me was they had a whole seminar on hedge funds. And one guy from Colorado, their pension thing, got up and he said, these things are highway robbery. Don't go near them.
Well, of course, most people cannot go near them, most investors.
Yeah, well, I mean, apparently institutional, you know, pension people can. And it was, and someone said it was noteworthy that they were even listening to it. These people are usually so sober. But what they were hearing was the returns are going to be so low, maybe we need to look for alternative investment vehicles to see if we can get a better return. And then the word risk came in. But this guy from Colorado says, not a cent of Colorado.
No hedge fund for him. Let's get one more call here. Luann is on the line. Welcome, Luann. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
Oh, I just wanted to make an observation about the demographics of getting into the market. I had a philosophy that during the surge of the 90s, a lot of that were the boomers with disposable income that could afford to get in. And we've had a big impact all the way through our different stages of lives, and that's one. And I feel like we're basically also optimistic people, and that we're just looking for a leader to come out there and talk to us in a positive way.
What does that boomer optimism portend in your mind?
In my mind, it's just bide your time and it's going to come back. It's not going to stay bad, but we do need a leader that can work well in a world situation because our growth depends on markets throughout the world, not just our own.
There's a vote for confidence and boomer optimism. Luann, thank you for your call. David Wessel, last thought. Does that seem in your mind to line up with public sentiment in the country? We don't have a massive bailout from the market here.
No, I think the public sentiment at the market is worried. I don't sense a lot of optimism at the moment. My gut tells me that this is a period of concern that'll pass because I think the president is right when he talks about the underlying U.S. economy is strong. But I am worried that when everybody starts to get gloomy all at once, that's when we could find ourselves in a situation that's difficult to get out of.
David Wessel, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief and Economics Columnist for The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Michael Goldstein, final thought. When all the headlines are bad, people have said in the past, that's the time to get in.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the contrary person tends to do well.
But it takes nerves of steel right now. Michael Goldstein, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Michael Goldstein is professor of finance at Babson College in Babson Park, Massachusetts. Jack Beatty, nice view of the mountains out there in Wyoming.
What a spectacular place. People should come and just see these mountains out here. It does my heart good. Of course, you can't get a lot of smoke in the air.
And one place you can still get a Rocky Mountain high, I guess. Listeners, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.